This is Going Up Alex, a podcast. Episode 4, High Performance Computing Part 1, a meta podcast. Welcome to another episode of the podcast Going Up Alleys, the rare occasional podcast. I'm your host, Stephen Sekula. And this podcast episode is going to kick off a series of, I guess what you would call, meta podcasts. So these are going to be podcasts about, or containing the audio of, other podcasts. What's the other podcast? Well, a couple of years ago, I was doing an official podcast for the SMU physics department called Mustang Physics. And I got very busy, my producer got very busy, and we never managed to connect on a series of episodes that I had recorded about interdisciplinary themes in the sciences and humanities. So unfortunately, those never saw the light of day, and I felt pretty guilty about it ever since, but I didn't have the time to care. Well, now I have a little bit of time to care, and I thought I would dust that audio off. That audio was recorded in the fall of 2011, and I thought I would dust off the audio that I used to introduce those recordings, which were themselves recorded in the spring of 2012. So you're going to hear me from the spring of 2012 introducing audio from the fall of 2011. I figured I would just recycle stuff that was already there. Why reinvent the wheel? So without further ado, here's me from the spring of 2012 introducing audio that I recorded in the fall of 2011 about high-performance computing. So there you go. The dog ate my podcast. I'm very sorry, listeners. If you were enjoying this show and you haven't been getting any episodes, it's all on me. But that's not to say I wasn't recording things through the fall and up till very recently. So every now and then there would be something that would catch my attention and I would get out the Mac and start recording and then think this will be great for the podcast next time I get an episode out. Well, I guess we finally reached next time. One of the other things that I had a pleasure of doing last fall was I served on a committee that the dean of Dedman College here at Southern Methodist University had convened in the summer. The committee's job was to establish a vision statement for an interdisciplinary institute as part of a much larger strategic plan for Dedman College here at SMU. And I was one of the many members of this committee. There were a few people from the natural sciences, and I was one of them. And the big goal of this institute is to not just incorporate disciplines within the humanities, which is very typical of other universities, but to really cut across Dedman College and find ways that the humanities, the social sciences, and the natural sciences can all tackle problems together. There are so many problems in the world that can't be solved within the narrow confines of simple academic boundaries. A few that jump to mind, for instance, well, climate change is a really good one that impacts all kinds of things. There's climatology, geology, physics, chemistry. You've got the social sciences, the psychology of people in zones that are affected by climate change. So where flooding is occurring or where sea levels are rising, where people are having to make real changes to their lives. There's just so many boundaries that topic cuts across that you can't even begin to talk about it in 30 seconds. So with that in mind, I realized that I had a few bits of audio that would make a great coherent theme for the next few episodes, and that is interdisciplinarity. So today's episode is going to begin this little series. It's actually going to seem a little strange. It's going to seem at first like it's not very interdisciplinary, but we had the pleasure of having a guest speaker last fall. The chemistry department at SMU hosted him and invited the physics department to participate along with other departments in the actual seminar, already a kind of interdisciplinarity, if you will, even if it was just within the sciences. But Tom Dunning came to us from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. He's the director of the National Center for Supercomputing Applications, or NCSA, and he's the director of the Institute for Advanced Computing Applications and Technologies. And in these positions, he has a broad view of the frontier of computing. And the reason that this begins to become an interdisciplinary thing is not just because computing is at the forefront of mathematics and chemistry and biology and physics. Certainly it is. But there are now efforts within other places where computing hasn't traditionally been something that's been needed, including the humanities, to do what's called digital humanities. That is, taking information which can be digitized or getting information that's already in some digital form and using it to learn something about people, whether it's anthropology, sociology, history, or any of the other disciplines like that. It could even be language, for instance. There are so many opportunities now as the data has grown and it can be mined, and you can think creatively about the data and how you're going to use it and how you're going to learn from it. These are problems that can be tackled only with what's called high-performance computing, or HPC. So Professor Dunning came to us last fall and talked about the state of the art in high-performance computing, what are the challenges, what are the opportunities. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to start playing part of the seminar that I recorded last fall, and then we'll cut at a convenient point, wrap up there for this episode, and then we'll come back in the next episode and finish off his seminar. And where we're going with this is that we also recently had another speaker, Dr. Robert Markley, also from the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. His expertise is history, and he spoke about using maps of the Great Lakes in order to learn something about how people not only perceived the Great Lakes as they were mapping them, but perhaps to teach us something about the way the Great Lakes actually looked at the time. This is a very interesting exercise and led to a lot of discussion at Dr. Markley's seminar. So what I'm going to do is start with the HPC recording that I made last fall. We'll go through an episode or two with that, and then we'll go into what you could look at as a very nice application in the digital humanities that stimulated a lot of discussion amongst the members of the audience at the seminar here at Southern Methodist University. Without further ado, I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Elfie Kraka. She's a professor of chemistry and also the chair of the SMU Chemistry Department. She introduced Professor Dunning, and then we'll hear excerpts from Professor Dunning's talk on high-performance computing, which he gave in front of a very mixed audience of students and faculty from many departments at Southern Methodist University. Let's have a listen.
So I think we should start. It's a real pleasure for me to introduce today's speaker, Professor Tom Dunning. And I see what is also very exciting, many faces not looking chemistry. So we have people from mathematics, physics, engineering, and I think that's really a good opportunity to meet all here. And of course, I especially welcome Dean Quick. So it's an honor for us to have you here too. Professor Dunning received his Bachelor of Science in Chemistry, 65, from the University of Missouri-Rolla, and his PhD in Chemistry from Caltech in 1970. Then, as usual, after PhD, you start to do a postdoc, so he did a postdoc first at Caltech and then at Battelle Memorial Institute. Then he took a position at Los Alamos, first in the laser theory group and then in the physical chemistry group. And then, probably, there was a little twist in his career, because then he was appointed at the famous Argonne National Laboratory as group leader of the theoretical chemistry group. Beginning in 1989, Professor Dunning had held several positions at Pacific Northwest National Laboratory, becoming a director of Environmental Molecular Science Laboratory, and he was the first Battelle Fellow in 1997. And then he spent 2 years in the Office of Science of the DOE as Assistant Director for Scientific Simulations. And probably after that time, you had the desire to go back to academia. So Professor Dunning then went to the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill as professor of chemistry, but he also was responsible for supercomputing and networking. In 2002, he was appointed director of the Joint Institute for Computational Sciences and distinguished professor of chemistry and chemical engineering at the University of Tennessee. And he also was distinguished scientist in computational sciences at Oak Ridge National Laboratory. And then finally, after all that, he decided to become more or less settled, which I think so since 2005. Professor Dunning is the director of the Institute for Advanced Computing Applications and Technologies and the National Center for Supercomputing Applications at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, leading a staff of approximately, where's Justin, 300 people. So this is, of course, far from what we ever will match. But he's also still doing actively research. He holds an endowed position as Distinguished Chair for Research of Excellence in the Chemistry Department at Urbana-Champaign. Professor Dunning is famous for the development of techniques for accurate solution for the electronic Schrödinger equation, the use of state-of-the-art computational approaches to understand structure, energetics, and reactivity of molecules. And those of you who have ever done a quantum chemical calculation, so who of you have ever done a quantum chemical calculation, you probably have used one of his famous basis sets, the Dunning basis sets. I came to ANL in fall of 1985 to work with Tom as a postdoc. This was the first time for me to be in the US, and I will never forget all the help I received from the Dunning group and especially from the Dunning family, so that I really felt home from the very first day on, and it was quite clear for me that someday I would end up here and live here forever. So that's basically your fault. I recall Tom.
I'll take responsibility.
Yes.
For that.
And then I recall Tom had chosen a topic for me, which I started with real skepticism. He wanted me to describe chemical reaction with a reaction path Hamiltonian. Very scary. But obviously he had a vision looking into my future, because this project turned out to be very successful, leading to a detailed understanding of many chemical reactions. And today the two of us decided that I will work on this topic for the next 50 years. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, the molecules become larger and larger, so I'm very eager to hear about an expert vision on the future of high-performance computer science. Please, Tom, go ahead.
Thank you very much, Alfie. It's certainly a pleasure to be here. It's a pleasure to talk to you about high-performance computing, but it would also be a pleasure to talk to you about chemistry. Most of you wouldn't be here if I were talking about chemistry. We're in a period. Can everybody hear me? I tend to walk around a lot when I lecture. So we're in a period in computing where technologies are starting to change relatively rapidly. So the computing technology that all of you are familiar with today, 5 to 10 years from now, is going to look radically different. And I'm going to talk about what some of these trends are, because it's very important for us as scientists, as computational scientists and engineers, to recognize what is happening with basic computing technologies, because in the end, our challenge is going to be, how do we use this new technology to do the science that's so important to do on computers? And I have to say, if I look at the University of Illinois itself, now the University of Illinois has long been a developer and user of high-performance computing technology, but what has been surprising is within the past 5 to 10 years is the broad use of computing across the university. So 10 years ago, if you had asked who were the major groups that we interacted with in the university, the answer would have been almost exclusively scientists and engineers, and primarily scientists, not so many engineers. That same question today, we would say that yes, it is still dominated by scientists and engineers. They are a majority, but they are barely a majority now, because we see many, many other groups from the humanities. Digital humanities is a major effort underway at the University of Illinois. You look at the social sciences, they are generating huge amounts of data, and it's the analysis of that data that really requires high-performance computing. So there are lots of areas of scholarship other than science and engineering now for which high-performance computing is becoming the basis for a whole new realm of research, one which relies less on speculation and one which relies much more heavily on data. And this is what makes it all very exciting. So what I'm going to do is to talk to you about the trends that we're seeing in computing technology. Some of those trends I'm sure all of you are aware of, and a number of you will be aware of at this point. Some of you may not be aware, but clearly there is a trajectory that we're on right now that is going to dramatically change the way that computing is done. It is important for us to recognize that and take advantage of it, as I said. I'm going to tell you a little bit about some of the very large computing systems that are being built here and across the rest of the world that is taking advantage of this new technology to reach levels of computing performance that certainly back when I started my work, which my first calculations were done on an IBM 1620, and the IBM 1620 is substantially less powerful than the computers that most of you have in your phones, your mobile phones, to the present date where we're talking right now about computers that can sustain a petaflop of computing capability. So that's 10 to the 15th arithmetic operations, and an arithmetic operation is you take two 14-digit numbers and you multiply them together. You get another 14-digit number. So if you would do 10 to the 15th of those in a second, you could compete with the types of computers that are now available. And we're already looking forward to the future when that number is going to increase by a factor of 1,000. So we're looking at what are called exascale computers. And within the next 10 years, those exascale computers will be here. What will be important for exascale computers to be here is not that there will be exascale computers, but there will be very cheap petascale computers, the computers that can perform the 10 to the 15th operation per second. You will have one here, I will predict, you'll have one here at SMU at that particular point. And the question will be is, can we use that technology to solve the problems that are of interest to you? So now's the time to start thinking about all of this. And I'll talk a little bit about what some of the issues are when we go beyond petascale computing, and then I'll sort of wrap up with some lessons that we've learned over the past several years. So let me first talk about what are the directions in computing technologies. I think most of you are aware that we are now going to multi-core chips. Many of you have laptops currently that have dual-core chips in them. The next laptop you buy may well have a quad-core chip in it, and that number is just going to keep increasing. Well, the same type of thing is happening in server technology, and it's even happening a little faster in the server technology. So clearly, multi-core chips are here, and we're going to see more and more cores on the chip. And the reason for that is that the computer vendors cannot increase the frequency of the chips any more than they currently have. So right now, you may have a chip in your machine that runs at around 300 gigahertz or 3 gigahertz. There aren't going to get substantially faster than that, despite the fact that back in 2000, I used to have the headlines on my computer that says, Intel predicts by 2005 we'll have a 10 gigahertz chip. They clearly did not make that, and it was basic physics. 10 gigahertz chips would produce so much power, you have to dissipate so much heat, that in fact the chip would have melted before it could have reached the 10 gigahertz itself. And any of you who have had your laptop actually sitting on your lap understand how much heat is produced by the current generation of chips. So if you look at what's been happening in computing, it's actually pretty exciting. So you look back just less than 20 years ago, back to the beginning of the 1900s. This is a plot of the peak performance on the Linpack benchmark as a function of time for the number one computer on the top 500 list. And the reason it only goes back this far is that Jack Dongar just started the top 500 list right in the beginning of the 90s. So back in the beginning of the 90s, about 93 or so, Jack published the first top 500 list, and the computer on that top 500 list, as you can see, was doing something on the order of 5 or so times 10 to the 10th arithmetic operations per second. So pretty powerful. On the other hand, you look at this machine right here. So this is less than 20 years later, and we have a machine now that's approaching 10 petaflops. So 10 times 10 to the 15th. This is the K computer in Japan. It just came on the line in June, so this is the June top 500 list. The top 500 list is produced twice a year, once in June and once in November. This is the system from the June list itself. So you can see this actually fits, amazingly, actually fits a pretty good linear relationship between time and the peak performance. And we have gone then from 10 to the 10th operations per second at the beginning of this to 10 to the 16th operations per second. So 5 to 6 orders of magnitude increase in computing power for the top computer in the world, basically. But there's been a big change that underlies that curve. That curve looks deceptively simple. There has been a major change that underlies that curve. And here is actually the frequency, how the Intel Pentium chips, many of these chips were used in those top 500 computers. This is the frequency of the chips as a function of time. And you can see up to about 2004, we are seeing that nearly linear increase in the frequency. 2004, all of a sudden they stopped. Why is this important? Barker at Intel said that roughly 80% of the performance increases we were seeing in our computers were due to this increase in frequency. So this increase in frequency is very critical because the power of the computer depends on this. So what happened? In 2004, everything flattened out, but the line kept going up. Well, there's only one way that can happen, and that is if you start using a lot more of these cores, a lot more of these chips. And so what happened, of course, is that in 2005, or so, Intel started producing dual-core chips. They were producing quad-core chips a couple of years later than that. A couple of years later than that, they're now producing 8-core chips, and 16-core chips are on the way. So for a long time, the increase in computing power was driven by this increase in frequency of the chips. But because of the heat dissipation problem, that leveled off in 2004, and now we're continuing up that curve only because we're putting more and more cores on the chip. So that means that if you don't have software that takes advantage of the fact that there are extra cores on that chip, you're not seeing any performance improvements. You won't be able to handle any larger science and engineering or humanities or arts or social science problem than you have been dealing with before. You may be able to do more of them, but you can't do any larger problems because to do that, your software is going to have to take advantage of the fact that there are additional cores on those chips and there are additional cores in the machine. And you're going to see in a minute the types of cores we're talking about for these leading class computing systems. And it's staggering numbers of cores that are available there. This is just a slide that shows you the Nehalem processors and how Intel went about developing that processor. Basically, they had things like cores, x86 cores, they had graphics units, they had QPIs, they have caches, and they could mix and mash and push those all on the chips and deliver you various types of chips. And you saw that coming out from the Nehalem family of chips. And this is basically the new mantra. You could have put 4 of those cores on a chip, you could put 8 of those cores on a chip. As they go to smaller and smaller feature size, Intel is basically now at 22 nanometers, so the feature size on the chips are 22 nanometers across. They're just putting more and more of these components then onto the chip, so you get more and more cores on the chip. Here are some current state-of-the-art microprocessors. The first two from IBM, there's the PowerPC processor that is in the BlueJeans series. supercomputers that IBM builds, and I don't know if some of you might be familiar with BlueGeneL and BlueGeneP, and now they're going to BlueGeneQ. This is the chip that's in the BlueGene, going to go into BlueGeneQ chip. This has 16 cores on each chip. In fact, it has more than that. It has 18 cores on the chip. One of them there is a spare, just in case one of the 16 goes out. They'll have one spare chip, one pair of spare core on the chip to be able to use to keep you at 16. The other chip is there just to execute the operating system. So that one chip is responsible for all aspects of the operating system itself. This turns out to actually be very important because it reduces something called OS jitter, which can actually rob you of a tremendous amount of importance in computers. You see the peak performance of that chip is 205 gigaflops, so relatively powerful chip, single chip itself. You have to think that when Cray introduced the first vector computer back in the 70s, which all of us were absolutely crazy about, was 140 megaflops. We're talking about 205 gigaflops here. So a tremendous increase in the amount of computing power since the late 1970s. Memory bandwidth, on the other hand, is a little constricted, 2.7 gigabytes per second. And this actually turns out to be something that's very important to keep track of, because when we analyze the use of the computers at NCSA, we often find that the processors are sitting there waiting for memory, waiting for data to be delivered from memory. So in fact, what's happening is rather than doing any useful work, the processor is sitting there spinning, doing no ops, waiting for the two quantities that it needs to multiply together to be delivered to it from the memory subsystem. So the smaller this bandwidth is, the longer it's going to have to wait to get that particular data. The Power 7 chip, on the other hand, is sort of at the other extreme. This is a chip that we had picked for the first version of Blue Waters. Now we're on Blue Waters version 2, and it won't be built with this chip, but you can see from this why this chip was so exciting to us. For example, it was running at a much higher frequency. It had only 8 cores on it, but it could achieve nearly 250 gigaflops. So with just 8 cores, it was doing far better than the PowerPC was doing with 16 cores. It also had a much higher bandwidth to memory. So you can see it had 16 gigabytes per second bandwidth to memory versus the 2.7 gigabytes. Of course, AMD and Intel are also very heavily in this game. The new processor that AMD just introduced is called Interlagos, runs at 2.3 gigahertz, it's either an 8 or a 16 core machine, depending on what's important to you. It has 8 CPU units, but each of those CPU units has 2 integer units associated with it. So if you're doing primarily integer work, it's a 16 core machine. If you're doing primarily floating point work, it's an 8 core machine. So you can see the chip manufacturers starting to play around a little bit with what it is they actually put on the chips. You know, is it better to have that extra integer unit on the chip? We think it's actually going to have an impact on some of the codes that are used to have that extra integer unit. 148 gigaflops, 6.4 gigabytes per second to memory, so somewhat better than what you can achieve with the PowerPC. But not as good as what you can achieve with the not nearly as good as what you can achieve with the Power 7 system itself. And Sandy Bridge is very similar. There is a difference in the peak performance of the system, but it turns out that this is a marketing difference, not a real difference. Turns out that when AMD tells you the chip runs at 2.3 gigahertz, the chip can actually adjust the frequency depending on the compute load that it's running. When we look at a normal compute load, this chip actually runs at 2.55 gigahertz per second under a normal compute load. When we look at the Sandy Bridge number, that's actually the absolute peak performance, and it's going to adjust down for that. So when we run it on an average workload, it's also around 2.55 gigahertz. So we need to talk to the AMD folks and tell them they need to change their marketing here. They look like they're doing much worse than Intel is, but in fact it's because they're talking about slightly different things. So that's the direction that we're going with multi-core chips. As I said, what you're going to see in the future is we're at 8-core now. Actually, there are some 12-core chips that are already out there. 16-core will be next. You know, 20 and 24-core will be after that. Pretty soon you'll have what was considered to be a massively parallel computer you're going to have on the chips themselves. So you have to start thinking about parallel computing in a very serious way, because this is the only way that you're going to get increased computing power in the future, is to be able to take advantage of massively parallel computing. And in fact, single chip massively parallel computing is already here. It's just not in the central processing units that you have on your laptop. Your laptop actually has another computing chip in it. It's the chip that paints your screen with all of the graphics and all of the numbers that come out. It's being painted up on the screen. It's called a graphics processing unit, a GPU. And one of the big changes that's happened in scientific computing within the last couple of years is that the people who make those chips have gotten interested in scientific computing, and so they've started to add features into those chips that make them easier and easier to use for scientific computing. And now you have a whole group of scientists and engineers that are starting to explore those machines, those chips, for their computations. And I'll show you in a minute what makes them so attractive. But NVIDIA, with its Fermi system, already has 512 cores on it. Those are simple cores relative to the cores that we were talking about earlier. But they are nonetheless, they can do integer arithmetic. Each of those cores can do integer arithmetic. Each of those cores can do floating point arithmetic. There is the Intel mini integrated cores, the mice. Intel has finally decided that it better get into this game also. And then finally, AMD with Llano has a very interesting strategy that I'll mention a little bit more later. So why are scientists so interested in GPUs? Well, this is the evolution of the GPU technology just over about the last 4 years or so. So we're only talking about 4 years or so of evolution here. So at the beginning of that period was the G80. It had 128 of these cores on it, but it didn't have any floating point units. It had no floating point units on it whatsoever. You had to do all the floating point in software. And clearly, you didn't want to do that. That really slowed your work down if you had to do the floating point in software. So this really wasn't too interesting. It was really when the GT200 came out that scientists all of a sudden got interested in this technology. But even here, you see, it can only do, each cycle, it could only do 30 floating multiply adds for double precision, whereas in single precision, it could do 240 of them. So it was there in hardware, the floating point was there in hardware, which you were paying a big price for being able to do the floating point. Now, with the latest edition of this, with the Fermi, now we're up to 3 billion transistors on the chip. And now look at this. Now they can do, each cycle, they can do 256 floating multiply adds, and they can only do twice that number in the integer. So they've really closed the gap on the double precision performance relative to the single precision performance. And why this is so exciting is if you just do a little bit of arithmetic, so 256 floating point multiply adds per cycle, that translates into 2 flops per floating multiply add. Multiply that by 1.5 gigahertz, which is a typical frequency for these chips, and you get something over 3/4 of a teraflop. So you've got one chip that's got over 3/4 of a teraflop of computing power on it. Here's actually what those chips look like. That's probably not so interesting. What is probably really interesting is this slide of NVIDIA's predictions of what the future is going to be. So you can see Fermi down here, and you can see the next generation chip, which will be out next year. These guys are on a really fast cycle. About every 1.5 years, they're continuing to turn out a new revision of the hardware. So Kepler is coming out, and this, it'll have 2 to 3 times the performance that Fermi has. And then you see by the time they get to Maxwell, dramatic increase in the performance. So this is why this type of technology is so exciting to scientists and engineers, is that with any single chip, you have a tremendous amount of computing power, and these guys are on a path that even if we view some of this as being marketing, they're still on enough of a path that makes it a very attractive technology for us to use in scientific computing.
Well, this is a pretty good place to pause. What we've heard so far from Tom Dunning is the state of the art in high-performance computing, the kinds of limitations that the machines have faced in the past, but also the kinds of technologies that exist now, both in the form of serial computing, traditional CPUs, and massive parallel computing, this more new idea of using these graphical processors and enhancing them and with having lots of them in large parallel systems to do scientific computing. In the next episode, we'll visit the second part of the seminar, where we'll hear more about what we can do with this technology, especially hybrid computers which combine CPUs and GPUs. What are the scientific problems across a vast range of issues that can be approached with this kind of technology? And what are the challenges going forward, especially scaling from what he referred to as the current generation, or petacomputing, petascale computing, to the next generation, or exascale computing? So we'll wrap up here, and we'll come back next time with another episode of Mustang Physics and tackle part 2 of this high-performance computing presentation, and then we'll move on to a specific application of computing in the humanities, looking at the Great Lakes and the way that they're mapped. So that's all for this episode of Mustang Physics. I'm your host, Professor Stephen Sekula, and we'll see you next time. This has been Going Up Alleys, a podcast by Stephen Sekula. Music was provided by Nikoko. The song is Occipital from the album Classicoco, available for download on Jamendo.